Okay, this is Series 2, Episode 12, and it's a genuine pleasure to meet Sasha Stiles.
Hi, Anthony. It's so nice to be here. Thank you very much for the invite.
Thank you for being here. I'm extremely impressed with the work that you're doing and envious, too, of the success you're having lately. An auction at Christie's a couple of months ago.
That's right. It was a nice way to end the year. a little December moment to remember, but likewise, I think, but I'll say it again here at the outset anyway, that I'm a huge fan of what you're doing, both your personal practice, which has been incredibly inspiring, and I'm really just in awe of your craft and your technique, but also what you're doing at Pinterakt, and the authors that you work with and the kinds of experimental poetics that you're championing, I think is so important. And I'm really happy to have stumbled into your circle. So yeah, again, very happy to be chatting with you, and thank you for the kind words.
And thank you. I don't just invite people on here to give me praise, but it's nice when they do. So I'll take it. So I normally like to start these with some backstory. And in your case, obviously, I'm interested to know how you got interested in poetry in general. But of course, then leading on from there, how you got interested in the type of poetry that you're doing, the digital poetry and especially AI influenced AI poetry in many cases.
Yeah, that seems like a great place to start. I think especially because over the past few years, there's been a lot of attention quite happily on the work that I'm doing with AI in particular and on digital poetry and NFTs. But as you hint, I do have a long, history of writing poetry off the blockchain and not using AI and other computational tools and techniques. So it's always nice to sort of remind myself of that, and I guess put that out there as well. But I've been writing poetry pretty much my entire life. I was really lucky to have been introduced to some incredible poetry by my parents, especially my father, when I was really young. I remember he handed me some of his childhood poetry books when I was really a kid and just learning how to read. And when I got a little bit older, I remember him giving me copies of his old Ted Hughes collections and things like that, and I just devoured them. And I don't know, I think I always really enjoyed wordplay in all different forms. And really just since I was, for as long as I can remember, just really, have found myself at home playing with language and really just devouring others' language experiments, but also learning how to kind of, get inspired by that and kind of refract that in the work that I'm doing as well. But, I've been writing my whole life, both poetry and short fiction and some nonfiction and essays as well. And it's really just, I think, under it all, that's the way I process the world. And that's the way I kind of understand myself. And it's really just what I love doing more than anything else. And that, I think, has really been the bedrock of a lot of the work that I'm doing now with computational poetry and with blockchain poetry as well. There really is this underlying and abiding love of the written word and lots of other forms. And just, coming back to this touchstone of using language as a way to articulate things that I don't quite know, what to do with until I, refract it through the mechanics of a poem. It's just how I have always kind of grappled with things. So it's fun to get to do that in lots of different formats.
Yes, I remember about a week ago, you did a tweet quoting T.S. Eliot, where he was talking about being a receptacle for language rather than trying to express himself.
Yeah, I love that quote. And it's not a quote from his poetry. It's a quote from his prose writings and from an essay called Tradition and the Individual Talent, which is, it's all about kind of the myth of originality and the idea that the myth of the author is sort of this individual genius kind of operating in silo and writing in a room with the windows and the doors closed and all that, and like the fallacy of that idea. And I think Eliot, is really writing about how the author, how the writer, how the poet is tapping into this kind of whirling mass of data that represents, everything that's been written and all the great and not so great texts that, have influenced the author's mindset. And obviously he was writing long before AI generative text really became a thing, but I find it really irresistible to think about that essay in particular and that quote in particular in relationship to a lot of the work that I'm doing now using data sets, plugging into, vast troves of written information and looking at kind of what it means to be a poet plugging into that kind of a canon as opposed to the canon that Eliot was referencing. Yeah, but I love that quote so much. I'm glad that that caught your eye and resonated. And I love Eliot in general, I think, is one of my most formative influences. And I really, in ways both literal and a little bit more subtle, he's been present in a lot of the work that I do and actually is in some of the training data sets that I've used to write with. So he's in my mind in lots of different ways.
The quote reminded me too of what John Keats said about the conflict between the egotistical sublime and negative capability. So there are those poets who want to write from within. They're
Yeah.
comfortable telling you about their feelings and their thoughts. And then there are those poets who want to be a lightning conductor.
Yeah.
They're speaking not from their experience, but from the world's experience through their writing.
Yeah, and I think that that's something that I obviously also think a lot, about when I'm talking about AI and thinking about plugging into these vast training data sets that power the language models, the large language models that I often collaborate with. It does kind of feel like tapping into a collective consciousness in a way that is sort of similar to what you've just evoked there. It's almost a way of kind of tapping into this cultural current in a way that's almost impossible if you're doing it just as an analog poet. We're all kind of in our, we're in our like prescribed circles, and we know what we know, and we don't know quite a lot of other things. And being able to use a model that in some way kind of refracts all of humanity's, written record is a way of plugging into a kind of collectivity that we haven't really been able to before, but that I think does almost fulfill something of that kind of poetic desire to really write something universal, very personal, but also very universal at the same time.
I was thinking about this in preparation for this interview, thinking about the comparisons between the kind of writing I do and the kind of writing you're doing. Because I'm not very techie. I'm not very good with computers. They tend to break around me. So, but I do obviously. It seems superficially there are similarities between constraint-based writing and AI-generated writing. I've talked about it in the past as being that I am collaborating with the constraint. It has this alien voice, which you could call an artificial intelligence. And every poem I write is a collaboration between my voice and this voice. And I have your book, Technology. Yeah.
Oh, so nice.
I'll talk about how good this is for a while, actually, because it
But
really is.
also, but I have this book here too, so we can
Okay.
talk about both at the same time. I've got Slate Petals here.
Is that the hardback?
It is the hardback.
Ah, well, you'll see these are printed by the same company. I noticed.
TJ Books.
TJ Books of
Oh
Cornwall.
my gosh, I didn't even notice that. That's so funny. So they've come from the same printer. Wow. Yep. Padstow, Cornwall, TJ Books. Well, that's very special.
Good advert for TJ Books, I think.
Yeah, and I love what they do. They're wonderful. Well, no wonder this book is really beautiful quality. And the content, of course, is amazing. But I love what you were just saying about the constraint being an artificial intelligence. I mean, I think that really, that's one of the reasons why I think your work resonates so deeply with what I'm doing. And also, resonates on a technical level in terms of working with some kind of a mechanical structure and using some form of automation to guide the writing process, but also on a deeper level, thinking about what an AI is, what an artificial intelligence can be. And I think a lot of what I'm, very fascinated by is kind of challenging the idea that an AI is just sort of, this sci-fi entity that is kind of what we recognize from, lots of kind of time-worn, cliched narratives, but thinking about an artificial intelligence in all these different forms and how it can sort of be a way to augment the human imagination or augment the analog imagination. So anything that can kind of plug into or clip onto or augment in any way what it is that we're doing as human, flesh and blood writers, I think all of those things are a technology in their own way. And as you say, I love the idea of thinking of a constraint as a collaborator. That seems very much of a spirit with a lot of the work that I'm doing, and a lot of the work that, quite frankly, a lot of electronic poets and now AI poets and folks who are writing with non-human co-authors, I think we all have a lot in common there.
With me, when in terms of this collaboration with a constraint, how heavy the constraint is depends how much I'm giving to this other voice. Because I could write with a really simple constraint and retain mostly my voice, or I could use a really difficult constraint and go over to the other. I mean, do you find something similar there? And how do you decide to what extent you're going to give everything over to artificial intelligence?
Yeah, I think that's a really great question, and I hadn't quite thought about it in the context of constraint-based writing until you mentioned it. But it really is a great kind of comparison, because I find it quite challenging trying to explain the processes that I go through in doing my writing, because I think the expectation is that when I'm working with an AI interface, I'm just pressing a button and letting an AI do all the work for me. Or, to get into it a little bit more, like, even if I'm spending a lot of time and attention and care crafting an algorithm or crafting the training data set underlying the, this interface, that once I press a button, that the machine is doing all the writing on its own. And I could do that, to some extent. That is a piece of what I'm doing, and that's definitely something that a lot of computational poets are very invested in. But I think for me, I really view it much more as an interactive collaboration, and much more like a kind of a feedback loop where, there's just an ongoing cycle of inputs and outputs, and each one sort of builds on the previous one. And there's a lot of there's a very sort of intimate, like, writing process that goes on once something comes out of the machine. I mean, for me, I think the raw material in and of itself is it's kind of a constraint in that it's throwing up, it's throwing up something interesting that I can then use as the foundation for a poem. And so I'm kind of looking at it and saying, well, now what can I pry out of this, or what can I carve away, or is there a piece of this that I can now use as the seed for something else? And so it's kind of giving myself a material and saying, now you have the challenge of, like, what to do with this material. It's not that I necessarily, have to use an entire generated chunk of text as is, although there might be cases in which that's interesting as found poetry. But often I really like the exercise of creating the text and then really working with the text in order to turn it into something that's not, not purely AI generated, not purely human generated, but something that really represents a collective effort. And I think that's really the voice that, to me, feels the most genuine, the most authentic, is when it's the two of us kind of fusing together and creating something of a third voice or a third entity.
The same for constraints, I think it's exactly the same. Although I also sometimes go back and forth between using really light constraints and really, really heavy constraints. So I imagine you, I mean, I think I can tell from technology that you have done this too, that you some days you feel more like letting the AI do have the major voice, and then sometimes no, you want to resist that, you want to keep to your voice. But it's good to have that variety.
Yeah, I mean, I think, and it's something that I really admire in your work too, is that it's not like you feel stuck in, like, one kind of category or one genre or one approach. I think, like, that's the fun of this, is that we can experiment in lots of different ways. And there's examples in my book of, for example, there's one long poem called "Are You Ready for the Future?" And the entire poem is a cycle of text outputs created by this AI powered alter ego, where I've basically created an entire poem just by asking the AI the question, "Are you ready for the future?" over and over and over and over again. So in that case, I am, using those found chunks of text as is, but I'm curating and sifting through them and excising, the outputs that I think are interesting. But the constraint there is that I'm only allowed to use one input, and then I can change some of the parameters that I'm using on the output. I can change some of the underlying controls and all that. But also, even if I don't change anything and I just repeat the question again and again and again, the input is always going to have a unique output. So I think that that's also really interesting to me, and just kind of points to the infinite variety, even when it seems like something is very constraint based or very repetitive, or very formulaic. There's always the opportunity for there to be a variation or subtle differences or not so subtle differences. So I think, that's fun to kind of play with that. And then, as you suggest, there's poems where I've gone in the completely opposite direction, and I've, maybe I've used an AI generated line as a prompt for me to write a poem, and there's, we're switching roles or something like that. But there's lots of different ways that I've played with collaborating with a machine co-writer in the book, and I think that for me was the real fun of getting to work on technology and not really have any, not have any like real expectations for myself about what the rule was regarding how to write with AI. It's just sort of saying you have this really interesting tool. There aren't really any rules about what to do with it, so just explore and experiment and see what feels, productive and interesting and exciting and generative.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what I love about it so much. You're not just and I don't want to insult other poets, but you sometimes see poets who they come up with a theme for their book, and then every single poem is relying on the same formula. And it's really nice to see this variety that you are explore, as you say, exploring all the possibilities.
Well, it's so new. I mean, it's like all of us are exploring it. And even, well, one thing that I find really interesting is there's quite a lot of attention being paid right now to AI, text, AI language. And a lot of it is coming from, mainstream publications that are talking about the B2B implications of AI generated text and all that. But it's caught fire very, very recently, but there's this much longer history of experimentation, both with AI generated language, but that even before that, many, many poets who, some of whom are in your circle, and poets that I'm friends with, and then more historical poets who've been exploring generative text for decades, and exploring computational poetry in lots of different formats. And I think, everyone uses these tools differently, and it's really exciting to be able to see, even though they're all relatively new tools in terms of the long history of literature and language, there's this desire, I think, to sort of say, well, how should you do this? And what makes this approach correct? Or, how should you work with an AI? Or how should you work with an algorithm as an author? And I think for me, again, it's like kind of crazy to think that way because we're still so early on in the process of all of this, that, really, like all I'm interested in is exploring and kind of adventuring and seeing what's possible rather than getting kind of into a mode of saying this is the correct way or that's the correct way. I don't think there is any correct way quite yet.
A few episodes, actually quite a lot of episodes ago, I think it was maybe even 2 years ago, I interviewed Nick Mompfit, and this was part of a panel episode, and I asked him a question, which maybe it was a stupid question, I don't know. I said, when do you think that computers will be able to write a novel that is indistinguishable from a novel written by a human? And Nick's answer to that was, why would anyone want that? He said, there are enough novels by people. I want to see how a computer writes a novel. And it seems interesting at the moment that this might be the last chance for us to explore this, because before long, they will be writing novels that look like human novels.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, that's exactly the sweet spot that I'm really fascinated by. And I think, like, again, Nick Mockford is such an amazing pioneer in this area, and I love his work, and I know, I've gotten to know him a little bit over the past few years, and I have so much respect for some of the contrarian views that he brings to the table and some of the discussions that I'm part of. I really value his really interesting and provocative feedback. But, and I think, like, I actually agree with, with a lot of what you were just alluding to. I think, on the one hand, as a poet who works with these technologies, I think probably one of the most frequent questions that I get asked is, can a machine write poetry, like can a machine write a human sounding poem? And my reaction to that does, I guess there's a couple different like reactions that I have, but the kind of the first and foremost gut instinct that I have when I hear a question like that is, well, why should we be necessarily wanting a machine to write something that sounds like a human poem? Like it's pretty clear we can train algorithms to imitate us. Like that's now been sort of proven. It's, that's what's happening with ChatGPT. And, there's poets that have been creating bots to generate poems in the style of, fill in the blank poet's name for years and years and years. And I think I'm much more interested in, what is it about the algorithm's sort of implicit workings that could be manifest in a generative poem that's not trying to necessarily replicate what a human could do or might do, but what are some ways that an algorithm could lead our literary imaginations that we're not doing ourselves or that we may not be equipped to? So I think I'm like much more interested in looking at the ways in which generated language is really doing things in its own way rather than sort of replicating the things that we're teaching it how to do. And some of my favorite moments in working with my AI generator have been where, there's little echoes of things that it's learned and echoes of things that are deep in its training data set, but it's then done something very weird. Like seemingly it's glitching or it's doing something that might be considered an error or something that normally like I as a poet would not do or that I'd go and erase or I'd scrap it. And those are always invariably the moments where I lean in and I'm like, I wonder, what is happening here? Like what is this algorithm sort of doing in this moment that is valuable as part of this literary exercise? So rather than looking at it as a glitch, I'm always like, is this some kind of a cybernetic emotion? Or like what is it about the way that the machine is breaking language here and doing something that it's not supposed to do that, that might be something I should pay attention to? And I think I feel that way because I feel like our role as poets is to break language and is to do things that are not expected with language. And so, teaching a machine to write something is one thing, but observing and watching a machine learn how to break the rules of good human writing is another thing. So I'm super interested in that side of it.
Yeah, and again, there's a comparison with constraints, with the more severe constraints, where I've written things and I looked at them and thought, I would never normally write that. In fact, no human being who's ever lived would normally choose to write it that way, but the constraints has done it. So I think that's
Yeah,
interesting.
I love that's true. It's exactly right. That's uncanny. Like that's that third voice or something that I really love. And I do feel like there's something about it that just feels to me much more genuine and much more true or much more real than when I was, trying to imitate Eliot or Plath or Sexton or Whitman or whomever. Like I always felt like I was doing something kind of artificial. And I feel like now using these different tools, I'm able to like tap something through these constraints, through this kind of automation, where I'm liberating the part of my brain that says a poem should be this, or you should be writing like that. And I'm able to access something different that feels truer to what I've been trying to do as a poet pretty much for my whole life. Is that how it feels to you at all when you're engaged in these enterprises? I mean, I'm very curious because I've been listening to the podcast and I'm a fan of a lot of the poets that you've interviewed, and I think I gravitate much more towards conceptual and experimental and constraint-based poetry and text-based art than I do a lot of contemporary poetry that we read in sort of the more mainstream channels. And yet, all my life as a poet, I've sort of been taught you should be writing like all these mainstream contemporary poets. And, I think one of the reasons I love what you're doing so much is it's just sort of saying, well, that's a kind of programming in terms of how to write, but it doesn't need to be that way. There's all these other ways where if you kind of liberate yourself from that expectation, or those sort of declarations by the literary establishment and the powers that be, there's all these other ways of really getting down to the essence of what it means to be playing with words and language. And yeah,
Yeah.
I find it so liberating.
At the Pentry Press, we say form in all its forms, and that's our mission.
Yeah.
Because I started out as a very traditional poet. I mean, metered formal poetry, so not even contemporary in the 1800s, perhaps.
Yeah.
And I still like that kind of poetry, but I'd like to see what else you can do. And I think seeing that sort of poetry as in its own way constrained by meter and rhyme, I then just started to explore other constraints and see where I could go with that.
Yeah.
And I've just carried on, really. And the visual side is very interesting. I only really dabble in visual poetry. You've been doing a lot, and of course, and then bringing AI into that. I mean, that's a fascinating area now. And I see some people posting their NFTs with all sorts of elaborate things going on. I mean, that's very exciting. And that's brought a new dimension to visual poetry.
Yeah, it's really exciting to see. I mean, there's so much to talk about when it comes to the kind of creativity that digital tools are enabling, and then specifically what blockchain is enabling. There's a lot of really exciting things happening there, which yeah, I'm excited to kind of get into that with you. I think also just like by way of background, it's again, like for me, I think I've always been a little bit less interested in poetry from kind of like the conventional literary point of view. And I've been very interested in language and wordplay as I've experienced it, like more through the language arts and literary arts and through text-based artists and through visual artists and lots of different mediums that are interpreting text or interpreting language or interpreting sound forms and things like that. So like I'm fascinated and obsessed by people like Jenny Holzer, who's one of my favorite artists and writes some of her own stuff, but also is using a lot of found poetry and found texts in her work as well. And just the way that someone like Holzer is able to completely well, kind of create an engineer a very profound immersive experience of a poem or a piece of text using using art and using different kinds of digital tools and pieces of equipment and things like that, I think just really creates kind of multimedia experience of poetry that feels to me, I don't know, very admirable or very interesting to explore versus just thinking of poetry as something that has to live confined to a printed page. And I'm someone that also loves books and loves printed, printed words, but I like the ability to kind of go back and forth and say it's one experience to read a poem in a book. It's one experience to kind of sit with words on a page, and it's a very different and equally valuable experience to engage with a poem with all of your senses. And it might show you different aspects of the poem or help you engage with the language on levels that you're not able to do when you're reading something on a page. So I guess for me, I don't think it's like it's never either or. It's never, 2D versus 3D or printed versus multimedia. Or any of that. It's like, how can we use all these different tools and mediums at our disposal to create this kind of literary ecosystem where we can really get deeper into, into the language of a poem and into the meaning of a poem?
There's so much to talk about here. Let's start with NFTs. When did you first start?
Let's see. Well, I've been making digital poems for a really long time. So like a long time before I entered the Web3 world. So that's been going on for a while, but I only started minting poems in 2021. I was sharing a lot of my digital poetry on social media, 2017, 2018, and started to slowly like realize that there might be opportunities to share art, not just in social media, but in virtual venues. And I was actually asked by a new media curator at the end of 2020 to write a poem for an exhibition that she was curating in the metaverse that happened to also include a lot of crypto artists and a lot of folks who are doing very interesting pioneering work with digital art and specifically with blockchain art. So that was my first real exposure, again, the end of 2020, to this amazing world of what was happening in crypto art. And I was kind of looking around, realizing that, you know, there was so much creativity and so much experimentation happening with different forms of visual art, but I really didn't see any writers in that landscape at all. And, you know, again, I was brought into this show by this really forward-thinking curator who was like, poetry would be great in this space. Like, we'd love to see poetry, you know, writ large in the metaverse, where you don't have to constrain it to a page. Like, we can put poetry on the sky, or we can put poetry, you know, in all these different formats. And like, that was really exciting. And it kind of broke open my imagination as to what I could do with poetry in those realms. And so I started, you know, just doing some exploring and doing some research on what it would mean to start minting poems. And I started at the beginning of 2021. And that's about 2 years ago now, which seems, you know, not such a long time in the grand scheme of things, but I think by crypto standards is ages and ages. But it's been a really, really exciting 2 years, and a lot has happened in that time. And there's been kind of a little mini explosion of writers, as you know, because I know you're kind of aware of what's been happening on Twitter. But there's been a really rapid rise of interest in poetry in blockchain. I think, you know, again, because there's so many opportunities to sort of push back on the traditional notion of what a poem is, and to utilize blockchain as a way to experiment with all the things that language can be, and to really, you know, reinvent, redefine how poems can be read and published and experienced and shared and celebrated, and also how they can be transacted, which is not always like a popular thing to talk about, but, you know, you're a publisher of books. I'm someone who also likes to sell my books. So there's that piece of it too. And I think using blockchain to also sort of redefine what it could mean to make a living as a poet is also a really interesting piece of this whole puzzle. So it's been really astonishingly exciting so far. And I still think we're right at the beginning of it all. So I think there's a long way to go and a huge amount of potential here. I'm curious about your thoughts on all of it, because I know you're...
Well, you know, every time I mention selling books on Twitter, somebody calls me an evil capitalist, so I can't win. What do you think of the perception of NFTs? Because, again, when I through the Pentract account, we've done polls on Twitter saying what do people think of NFTs, and a lot of people get extremely angry about them for various reasons. There's an environmental concern, and then there's the idea that there are scams going on, then some people think the whole thing is a scam. I mean, how do you counter that?
Yeah, I mean, there's a few different things there. So on the environmental level, I think that was the first thing that I was myself quite concerned with. And when I began minting, actually my first sort of concerted effort to do so was on a blockchain called Tezos, which is a proof of stake blockchain, which means that it's very energy efficient. And is a very different animal from the proof of work blockchains that really do consume a lot of energy and are much more, have a heavier impact on the environment. Now, there's been a lot of changes in those protocols, so that, you know, even kind of the big blockchains that were getting sort of, maligned for their environmental impact have now changed protocols in significant ways, so that things are much, much lighter. And in most cases, I mean, you can, depending on where you research and the studies that you reference, I mean, I've read a lot of stats in doing my due diligence on this that talk about the kinds of NFTs I'm minting as being no more energy intensive than sending a tweet or writing an email and firing that off. And, you know, all of us do that. So, I think, you know, in the flurry of, you know, the big crypto explosion in the beginning, I think it was easy for people to kind of come out and talk about the environmental impacts without really digging into the nuances of what was actually happening. And I think, you know, that's a pretty easy one to just do some research and learn about the different possibilities of where to mint and, you know, how to mint in a way that is in aligned with your values. And not just in terms of the environmental impact, but also in terms of the people who are part of a blockchain community, or the people that are running a specific platform that you want to be part of, I think there's lots of decisions to be made about, choosing ways to mint NFTs that are in alignment with your values and that you can feel really good about. And that just requires doing a little bit of digging, but it's certainly possible to do this in a way that squares with, your one's values. So I think like that's the first thing, is just kind of giving people a crash course and trying to explain that, when we're talking about NFTs, it's not like there's one way to do it. It's not like there's one kind of NFT. There's lots of different ways to approach it, just the way there's lots of different ways you can shop for clothing, for example, and some of them are sustainable and some of them are mass market. And there's lots of, you can do it in a good, responsible way, or you can do it in a way that is a little bit more careless. And it's the same thing with working on the blockchain. So I think, that's one piece of it. I think the other big thing for me has been, trying to share with fellow writers and fellow poets the reason that, or the fact that I've gotten into NFTs and that I've really become kind of an ambassador for their potential for writers, not because, they're an easy way to get rich quick. Like, they're certainly not. And that's not, it's not been my personal experience at all. Like, what to me is really exciting about it all is the way that it has dramatically cracked open my practice as a writer and has really forced me to reconsider a lot of the things that I thought I understood about what it means to write and publish, and to share the things that I'm working on and to establish a community. And it just has forced me to sort of, rethink a lot of the conventions that I've been taught. And I never did an MFA. I've done, workshops here and there, and I've done a lot of self-directed study, and I've done a lot of conferences and stuff, but I still feel, like, as a part of the kind of the wider literary community, there's certain expectations and certain paths you are expected to follow and all that. And I think what's been really exciting on the blockchain is that there's this new way of being a writer where you can kind of circumvent some of those expectations and go, straight to an audience that's interested in the things that you're interested in. And you can really build relationships in that way. And you can publish things that maybe a traditional publisher isn't going to care about. And you can really focus on going deep into the things that are fascinating to you in a way that you can't always do in other careers that are available to writers. So I think there's a lot of creative justification for exploring what's possible with NFTs. And that's like on a very superficial level. And when you get into the actual mechanics of how you can mint things on the blockchain, and you can mint something as a PDF, or you can mint something as a generative art project and like create a poem that is different every single time it's printed, via the blockchain, for example. You can create, a novel that never ends, and that's like an interactive experience. You can really just, you're limited only by your imagination and your ability to connect with creative coders and technologists that can help you build the kind of literary object or literary experience that you have in mind. And I think that to me is also just like profoundly exciting.
It's always nice if you can sidestep the establishment, I think. And
Yes. It
of course,
definitely is.
and of course, you've done this while building a community too. We should talk about the verse first.
Yeah. Basically, the verse first, and thank you for asking about it, is it's an NFT poetry gallery, basically. And it really is meant to be sort of a little hub within the metaverse and within the world of crypto art, specifically for poets and writers of lots of different stripes and approaches coming together to really explore what we can do with language using the blockchain. And it came about because, again, beginning of 2021, I was dabbling in all of this and feeling quite lonely because there weren't a lot of other writers in the Web3 space. And over time, started to meet a few other writers here and there, and we were all kind of looking at each other like, oh, there's another writer here, thank goodness. And started to kind of cohere into a little mini community. And I think we really realized there was strength in numbers, and there was something really powerful about being able to connect with other writers in the space Because again, there was no precedent for what we were doing. There really were no rules. There were no platforms. There were lots of crypto art platforms and lots of examples of crypto artists doing great things, but there weren't really any examples of what crypto writers could do in the space. And there were no dedicated platforms for text-based art or for literature in general at that time. So I think we really, I and my two co-founders at the Verseverse, Kellen Iwamoto and Ana Maria Caballero, we all, come from very different backgrounds, but we all kind of immediately clicked and connected over this idea that we needed some kind of a community. We needed some kind of a hub where the writers in this world could kind of join together and share what we were going through and kind of brainstorm ideas together and, just try to think about what it was that we wanted to build together. So the Verseverse really grew out of that, and we launched, God, the end of November 2021, which again, in one way feels like, a second ago, and in other ways, like I can't believe how much has happened since then. But it's been a really interesting experience to see how the Verseverse has been very warmly welcomed into the crypto art space, very much to our surprise. We've had a lot of artists and curators and journalists in the crypto space who kind of astounded us by taking an interest early on, and really have made time and space for us. And it's been really wonderful to see that. And I think one of the reasons why is because there are a lot of resonances between poetry and blockchain, between poetry and technology in terms of what it is that poets do. And my whole like line on this, and I get into this a little bit in technology, is that I really think that poetry, isn't just some sort of enigmatic art form that is handed down to us like from the muses. That, I think that poetry really is a kind of code, and that poems are a form of technology. And I actually think, and I've kind of put a fine point on this since getting into Web3, but I really think that poetry is a data storage system, and it's something that humans invented so that we could save information and save stories and transmit really precious, human data through time and space and from generation to generation. And the more I think about it, the more I realize that poetry actually is the original blockchain. Like, it is a way of preserving things and making them immutable. And some of the oldest traces of human imagination are poems, and ancient poets have essentially succeeded in this very, sort of newfangled Silicon Valley attempt to defy death and become immortal. People like Horace and Sappho and Catullus and all those folks
And
like have lived
Hedwana.
on and Hedwana, exactly, above and beyond all the rest, perhaps. And I actually love that someone like and Hedwana, in a lot of the research about her, she's not just called a poet, she's also called an inventor and a technologist, because she really was someone who innovated the idea of literature and created tablets and kind of a book structure, and really did a lot to invent a tool that we still are using and innovating on to this day. So I think there's a lot of connections that are implicit between poetry and between a lot of the work that we're doing in Web3 on the technological side. And I don't know, I think I just sense in some way that's why there seems to be this affinity between coders and those of us who are working with the algorithms and patterns and rhythms of words and language. There's just some kind of instinctive like pull that I think has been really helpful to what we're doing and has, been really fun to dig into.
It's coincided with the pandemic. Do you think that's been a factor in this, having to be online?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think that has something to do with it. I know that, a lot of the initiatives that I've become really involved in over the past few years started in 2020. And that's not by coincidence. It's because a lot of the things that we were doing in person had to migrate into a digital realm or, get transformed into some kind of a virtual experience. And yeah, I think that's had a big impact on our desire to figure out how we can create, experiences of, for example, poetry performances that can exist in the metaverse, or, how can you have a meaningful poetry reading or something like that, not in person, but how can you do that facilitated just, through a platform like Zoom or a platform like Decentraland or something. So I think there's been a lot of interest and emphasis on how to, even though we're not physically in the same space, how do we use something like poetry to really forge a connection and to make us feel that we are, in some kind of metaphorical room with other like-minded people. So I think that's definitely been part of it. And I've been kind of, I've been really touched and again, kind of surprised by the fact that whenever we host the verse-verse readings, either in the metaverse or on Twitter spaces or, wherever it may be in like in the disembodied virtual realm, we get a lot of really good feedback from people who I think, really feel like there is a genuine connection in whatever that, that roomless room is. And it's because everyone's brought together by poetry. So I think there's something really important about that. And it does definitely link to, I think, the disconnection that a lot of us experience with the pandemic.
I have one more question about NFTs, and this is essentially you trying to convince me to get involved. From what I've seen, visual poetry and visual art, that seems to be doing quite well, and minimal text seems to work.
Yeah.
What about longer text poems? Are they likely to be successful on the blockchain?
I mean, I think so. I think that there's actually quite a few examples of longer form poetry. Yeah, I mean, there are a number of examples. Like, there's a really wonderful poet named Lawrence Fuller who's been making movie poems, like kind of cinematic poems, for quite a while. And, they're not like book length poems, but they're a few minutes long, and there's VO, and you kind of experience it as a spoken word performance. It also has visuals, and I think it's an interesting way of engaging people in a poem that's longer than, just a few words in a text block or something like that. And I mean, there's lots of examples that are kind of more in that zone where a longer poem can live, in different formats. And there's also, quite a lot of projects, and I've done quite a few myself, that use generative platforms as a way to create long form poetry. Take either a very long poem cycle and explore it and present it in different ways and kind of break it down and make it accessible to kind of to read and understand at the line level, or to kind of look at the project as a whole and engage with it as a bigger text. There's definitely examples of things like that. And then of course there's a whole new generation of NFT books that are being published on lots of different platforms. And some of those are as simple as kind of minting a PDF version of a book. But a lot of people are really exploring that idea much further and kind of innovating what a book could be, in the world of Web3, and thinking about how to create an engagement with a longer text, whether it's a longer poem or maybe a short story or maybe a novel, or something different. And there's now like a whole there's a whole group of writers like Neal Stephenson, and I think Tim Ferriss actually just released a whole collection or a whole project, a literary project. But there's lots of different writers that are exploring with kind of projects that push beyond the idea of kind of a minimal text-based approach, and are really looking at how to create a space for storytelling in, I don't know, in a more time-based or durational sense, like creating a space for really kind of deep and engaged interactions with the text or with the protagonist in lots of different ways. So I think there's certainly a lot of innovation happening there, and there's not one definitive way that I've seen in terms of how to do that. But I mean, for someone like you, I think there's certainly a lot of interesting ways you could take individual poems and present them as art pieces. And I think a lot of them would be really exciting and beautiful to interact with in some way. But then there's lots of, I think, interesting ways to think about turning a book into an NFT ecosystem. Or, like I'm working right now on sort of the NFT version of technology, and it's taking different forms. I'm kind of using technology as a source text to kind of explore different ways that the book could exist on the blockchain. And one way is just long poem movies, kind of like I was saying before. I've got quite a few pieces that exist as 5 minute or 8 minute or 12 minute poem movies. So there's that approach, but also I've been kind of looking at ways to collect all the different examples of NFT poems that are related to the book and put them into one marketplace or one sort of page where you can, it's not like reading a book per se, but you can go to one destination and kind of browse through all the different digital iterations of a poem and kind of experience them in lots of different levels, which is maybe like a new way of thinking about engaging with a longer form text.
This is exciting. I'm having ideas, and I'll have to restrain myself.
Well, I'd be happy to brainstorm anytime. I think like it's been really interesting to me that there's a lot of investment in NFT technologies in so many different ways, and I haven't seen a lot of real energy or effort so far going into really innovating the idea of what NFT book publishing could be. And I find that kind of bizarre. I think there's a default state of, let's turn this book into a PDF and then mint the PDF as an NFT,
You can
which
mint it
is,
as different edition, the first edition, the second edition, the third edition.
You definitely can. And there's lots of things you can do with that too. You can play with different approaches to personalizing or customizing or creating author signatures or whatever the case may be. There's lots of ways to kind of customize the experience, but I think there's also a lot of opportunity to really just again like push back on the idea of what a book looks like. I mean, for me, one of the analogies that I like is that a lot of the discussion about the metaverse has to do with the architecture of the metaverse and our experience of being avatars moving through the metaverse. I don't know if you've had much occasion to be in the metaverse or to go exploring there. No.
No, basically none.
It's kind of like being in a video game or something. And there's, depending on where you are, there's lots of different ways to move around. And in some places I've been, you can actually like, you're walking down the street and you can decide that you want to jump up to the roof of a building and go explore. And the point being, in the metaverse, you don't necessarily need to take an elevator. You don't need to walk up a flight of stairs. You can just fly if you want to because there's no constraints, such as gravity holding you back. But that being said, a lot of architects in the metaverse do build staircases and do build elevators because that's what we're used to. And we, there's something nice about that grounds us and that makes us feel like this is a little bit more familiar. And for me, I sometimes think of pages in digital books as being like stairs in the metaverse, and that's how we're used to engaging with a text, and our brains are primed to kind of flip the page and move through a text that way. But, and I really appreciate that. And again, I see a lot of value in figuring out how to do that in a very interesting way in the virtual space. But I also wonder if we need pages, for example, or if there's just wholly new ways of engaging with texts. And I think, that's something that, again, like we're very much at the beginning of, but I also have a lot of ideas there, and I'm really excited to have more opportunity to collaborate with various, tech platforms and creative coders to start putting some of them out into the world and to really just play with, what these different forms could look like and how in turn they could change the kind of content that, we're putting into a book.
It's a weird thing though, isn't it? Metaverse. Just floating
Yeah.
around there. Ray Kurzweil blurbed your book.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, so obviously you're assuming you're a fan of his ideas. I mean, some of that stuff's crazy. Really is, in the best possible way.
Yeah.
Do you believe him? Do you believe what his predictions? I mean, so far they seem to be pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a huge fan of Ray Kurzweil and his imagination. I think he's such a creative person. He's really just so imaginative. And he also has done a lot of experimentation with poetry throughout the years, which is one of the reasons that I asked him to read the book. One of the projects that I consider formative to the work that I do is his Cybernetic Poet, which I think has been around for at least 15 years or something, but it was this bot that he built to kind of to create haiku in different styles. And yeah, I mean, again, I think a lot of what he's thinking about in terms of transhumanism, I do really believe in. And a lot of his thinking, as well as the thinking of people like Martine Rothblatt, who's another futurist and inventor, who also is, has crazy, crazy, amazing ideas. I think a lot of what they think about in terms of how we can use technology to sort of improve and augment the human condition is really of interest to me, and I think is worth exploring and like worth taking seriously. And like you say, a lot of the things that these visionaries talk about and sort of predict like does come to be. And I think part of it is because we speak things into existence, and we can only invent things or build things that we're able to like put into language in some way. And people like Ray Kurzweil spend a lot of time not just kind of imagining these crazy things, but then outlining how they might work, and really thinking through like the system by which they might come into existence and all that. And I feel like that again comes back around to the power of language to help us, bring things into being. So I'm very interested in both, the ideas that he's expanding, but also thinking about the importance of, allowing for that kind of very far-fetched imaginative view of what might come next, as opposed to having a knee-jerk reaction and saying NFTs are terrible, or digital immortality is, horrifying and against nature. I think there's something really interesting about leaning into the ideas and considering, even if you don't believe wholeheartedly in them, or you think there's parts of it that could be a little dangerous. I think there's seeds of things that are really important and interesting to help us get past some of the really horrible moments that we've been in recently, and the horrible, state that we as a human race find ourselves in now. I think we do need to have really creative solutions that radically kind of alter our trajectory in a lot of ways. So I'm not a techno optimist necessarily. I think I'm more a techno realist, but I'm also someone who would much rather lean into creative solutions than kind of criticize or stick to something familiar just because it's what we have.
So for anyone listening who doesn't know about Ray Kurzweil, the theory is called, it's a singularity, isn't it? And it's 20, we're around 2045. By 2045, humans will be able to, in theory, upload their consciousnesses to the cloud, I guess, or the metaverse.
And yes, and sort of kind of like a reciprocal, this is maybe like paraphrasing it in a slightly strange way, but kind of a reciprocal relationship between artificial intelligences and between human intelligence in that way, so that they kind of, are working in symbiosis, and that an artificial intelligence can do things that a human intelligence can do. Yeah, in 2045, and again, sort of seems very far off, but also seems very close. And seeing a lot of the recent developments, for example, with OpenAI's ChatGPT, which is a generative pre-trained transformer, that uses large quantities of written information to mimic human speech and human writing. Like the advances in that over the past 4 or 5 years have been pretty staggering and exponential. So it doesn't seem that far-fetched, to think that a lot of the hypotheses that people like Kurzweil are floating are, rooted in some kind of reality.
Chat GPT is astonishing. I've seen some examples lately that are mind-blowing. But also, every so often, somebody will tweet me with, Anthony, your job is safe. And it'll be a screen grab of where they said, write a palindrome, and it can't do it. So it can do lots of things. It can't do palindromes yet.
Well, I will say also that I mean, it is kind of fun playing with ChatGPT to write poems, but a lot of the poems that are generated with kind of the default settings on ChatGPT are very, they're like rhyming poems, and they're like very rudimentary, and a lot of them are pretty bad by all measures. I think you would agree. So like, some of them are technically speaking they're grammatically correct, and maybe they're adhering to a certain kind of structure, and the rhyme is correct, and they can probably adhere to meter in lots of ways that I personally can't do because I'm not very good at that sort of thing. But yeah, they're not. I don't think that the poems that it's generating are really giving you, for example, a run for your money quite yet. So
Yeah, but 10
there's
years
lots
from now, who
of,
knows?
who knows? We're getting closer.
What about the visual AI generators? I signed up for a Mid Journey trial about, I guess, about 18 months ago, and it blew my mind then. And the way that's improved just in the last 18 months is astonishing.
So I'm really fascinated by a lot of these AI visual programs too. And I think for me, I just keep coming back to the fact that they're rooted in text as well. And like they're actually, a lot of those generators like Midjourney are they're text to image generators, right? So they work, like for anyone who doesn't know, they work by, a human input, a human sort of statement or a description of an image output. Is kind of the starting point for everything. So it really requires being able to explain what you want the generator to create. And I think it's really interesting that again, it kind of comes back to language and being really precise and being very like intentional in terms of what you're typing into that input box. But yeah, it's been astonishing too to see the evolution in those tools and how powerful they are and how they really, well, I will say this, it's interesting because I think there's so much blowback about creative AI, and a lot of it centers on tools like Midjourney and DALL-E 2, and how there's this sense that a lot of the outputs all kind of look the same, or there's a generic, AI visual aesthetic emerging. And I think that's because so many people are using the tools in the same way and kind of following the examples that are set, but they're so powerful and I think, they're really fun to just experiment with in very off the wall ways too, and to think about how you can sort of hack those kinds of tools and make them do things that they're not supposed to do, or create visuals that are maybe not intended. And like that's to me, like that's so much fun. I haven't minted a lot of work that involves using text to image, but I've done some experiments that actually involve asking DALL-E 2 to create text or to create language or to play with, text-based art in different ways. And that's always really interesting to me because what those systems haven't quite mastered yet is how to really understand language from a visual point of view. So those systems are really good at creating, beautiful photorealistic pictures of things that never existed, for example. But if you kind of ask it to write or to create a picture of a poem, the language, the text is usually acemic, or it's not legible, or it's some kind of crazy, fictional depiction of a language. And I find that like super fascinating as well. So there's lots of cool layers to play with those tools. And I'm eager to see what you've been doing with Midjourney. Like that's I haven't seen
Oh,
much of
only
any.
basic stuff.
Interesting.
But there's one thing I wanted to ask you about with visual AI is that there's been some controversy lately about having computer generated images based on other people's artistic styles. And I know a couple of artists who've said that if I see that they're using my style to generate images, I'm going to sue everybody, which to me seems like a bit of a overreaction. Have you noticed this as a problem?
Well, it kind of comes back around to Eliot. We started talking about that Eliot quote, and the quote being something like, a poet should write with all of the history of literature in one's bones, and like the implication there being that everything we do is kind of refracting things that have already been done and then processing it through our own imagination and like creating some iteration on that. And I feel like that's kind of the core of what all creative endeavors is. I mean, none of us create in a vacuum. We're all responding to, other creative efforts, and we're all kind of iterating and offering our unique take on it. And it does seem a little strange I think to harp on you know, as you say, like this idea that if you put your work into a data set like that, that it's copying as opposed to kind of having that material be important information that's then influencing in the way that, you know, you hope as an artist your artwork would be influencing people in the real world. So I don't know, it's kind of a funny thing. It's definitely not good when anybody directly copies someone else, you know, for mercenary reasons or does it maliciously, but I think, you know, part of the ethos of this new like movement of crypto art in general, and a lot of what's happening with digital arts and new media is about collaboration and about kind of you know, this collective consciousness, right? And leaning into that as a way to invent really interesting things. So it seems a little counterintuitive with that as the background to then be kind of doubling down in this idea of, you know, originality as something that has rigid walls around it and that can't be permeated. It seems like a very old-fashioned way of approaching it in some way. But
Yeah, there's a big
and I
difference. Yeah, there's a big difference between stealing someone's work and being inspired by their style. The music industry is in a bit of chaos now because people are now suing each other based over songs that have the same feel. I mean, try defining feel. It's
That's a really
madness.
good question. Like, how do you quantify that? How do you qualify that? That's very difficult. Same thing with the poem. It's like, you know, no one has like a hold on or a copyright on, you know, writing like a certain kind of AI generated poem, or no one has, you know, claims on writing poems about love, or I, you know, I don't know. There's infinite variations on any one theme, and that's kind of the point, is that you know, there's myriad possibilities, and it's kind of interesting to see how they all stack up against one another and how they kind of add up to something that's greater than the sum of their parts.
Yeah. How are you doing for time, by the way? I'm aware that I've kept you for over an hour now, and I still have lots of questions. We can end whenever you like.
No, that's okay. Well, I'm at your disposal if there's like other burning questions, for sure. But I'm mindful of your timing too, and I don't want to take up too much of your it's evening where you are, so it's late.
Okay, we're doing okay. There are just a few things left, I promise. I won't be too long. So here's one. What comes next? What's the future medium for art and the future medium for poetry? Bearing in mind, we'll be living in this great Kurzweil world of where anything goes.
I know. Well, it's hard to say because I, like you, am also very much a bibliophile, and like I think the most precious objects that I have in my possession are physical books. So I'm very wedded to physical art and physical literary objects, and having that kind of a tactile engagement with something is very important to me. And at the same time, I really do think a lot about this idea of digital nomadism, which is something that, for example, like Kevin Kelly has written a lot about. But this idea that we're evolving towards, in some way, we're like regressing to kind of a nomadic tradition where we just are very light on our feet and we have what we need in our digital devices, and that's enough to take us from place to place and experience to experience. So I don't know. I'm a little bit ambivalent about it, I think, because I'm very wedded, like I said, to certain analog experiences. But I'm also very interested in how tapping into the digital side of things enables us to take what we need with us in a much more convenient way, and to not be burdened by like the realities of, you know, for example, carrying my book around the world has been very tough on my shoulders. Like, it's a heavy book.
It's a big book.
It's a big book and it's heavy. And you know, I've been very happy to take it around the world to, you know, to share it at readings and events and things like that. But I'm always like, I'm like kind of lopsided now because it's always on one side of, you know, on this shoulder. And so figuring out a way to be able to share this book in a way that feels as special to me as handing someone a physical copy, but doing it, you know, as a virtual transaction, I think to me, like, that's sort of a holy grail in some way. And, you know, I don't know what that looks like yet. That's kind of why I'm casting the net and trying a lot of different experiments now, is to sort of think about how I get to that point. But I think there is something there that, you know, that will take us into the future of publishing and the experience of literature. And I really do think that I guess there's two sort of big categories that I think a lot about when I think about kind of what's next. And there are things that are already in the offing, but we're still in such early stages that I think we barely have scratched the surface. And one is, unsurprisingly, generative text and algorithmic authorship. And obviously that's become a little bit more mainstream in the art world. And I think when it comes to literature, there's a lot of really exciting potential for using AI to enable lots of different people to express themselves and to be creative with words in a way that they weren't able to before. And for very seasoned writers to then like go a step beyond and kind of unlock something new using these tools. So I feel like there's a lot of really incredible potential with these AI large language models that I don't think I even quite understand yet, like just how earth-shattering it may be for literature and not just for writers, but for all of us, because we all use words. So I think a lot about just the profound moment that we're in with AI-generated language becoming something that is more and more familiar, literally with each passing day. It seems very important to really grapple with all that that means and to understand the ways in which that might be used productively, and can be exercised in a valuable way versus using it to write college essays or plagiarize whoever. And there's all these negative ways, I guess, or nefarious ways to use it. But I think it stands to be such an astonishingly powerful tool that I'm very invested in continuing to do these experiments and really think more deeply about really what directions it can lead us in from here. And then the other is, of course, thinking about blockchain and Web3. And I think we're still at a point where, as you say, a lot of people are very skeptical of NFTs, similar to the way that people were skeptical about the internet, for example, or skeptical about
The car, the anything really.
car, the telephone, the book, the advent of written language. Like all those things were considered quite scary and dangerous as well at some point in time. So I'm really interested in NFT as a sort of a technology on par with the printing press, and thinking about how someone like Gutenberg and the others who are working on innovations with regard to movable type, the dramatic impact that that had on everything, on how information is distributed and the kinds of genres of literature that developed. And the impact that that had on the human imagination, just thinking about the far-reaching implications of a technology like that, I think is in the back of my head when I think about NFTs. And I often think about NFTs as a sort of bespoke printing press, where you can actually use this technology to not just, for example, print, 100,000 copies of a book, but you could theoretically print 100,000 copies of a book in which each one is unique, or in which each one has a slightly different utility, or fill in the blank here. I think there's so many different ways you could use it, but to me it's mind-boggling to think about all the ways that we could utilize blockchain for printing and distribution of literature. And then beyond the mechanics of that, like with Gutenberg, like what impact will that have on the kinds of stories that we're telling, or the way that we narrate our existence in the world, or the way that the imagination puts ideas together. I think, it's just fun to start to grapple with what some of that impact might be. And again, I think like we're right at the very, 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 very beginning of it. So it's hard for me to really make useful predictions about where it goes. But I think again, like that's why I'm interested in being in this area that I'm in right now, because anything can happen, and it's sort of it's on the people who are here now building and creating and envisioning ideas to sort of shape where we go from here on out. So that's again one of the reasons why I'm really invested, not just in doing what I'm doing, but also making sure that I onboard other writers and and talking about these things to journalists and to publishers and making sure that it's not just this tiny little niche area, but that we can hopefully join forces and get some some really interesting things cooking.
Yeah, and it's very interesting how certain media, you know, they're immortal. Like books are,
Yeah.
nothing's replacing books. There was panic 20 years ago when e-books came through, and everyone thought that was going to destroy books forever. It doesn't. It's been
Yeah.
interesting to see the revival of vinyl records,
Yep.
but they seem to be the one that's going to outlast all the others. And we don't know what's of the new media is going to survive, but it's fun just finding out, and it's fun experimenting with
Yeah.
any possible media you can get your hands on. So I think that's probably the message there. Just keep trying things.
Yeah.
Some of them will stick, some won't, but it's all good fun.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
So one more question. I was going to turn this into a big conversation, but I think it might be funny if I just ask you and you answer yes or no, and then we end the podcast. I was going to ask you about your thoughts on simulation theory. So, yes or
Okay.
no, are we living in a simulation?
Oh my God. Are you sure you don't want to put more context behind that?
What layer of the simulation are we in? Are we a base one reality?
Well, yeah,
No.
this is where it's like impossible to give a yes or no. Well, it's impossible for me to say yes or no to anything because I like to ramble on about it. But I mean, I think everything that works, I think yes, in the sense that there are so many different layers to reality, and there's no one sort of, I don't think there is one definitive sort of reality. I mean, I've done a little bit of research on like base reality and all that, and thinking a bit about multiverses and simulation theory and all that. But I don't know. I mean, I'm definitely not like an expert on any of those things, but I do like thinking about, again, sort of the metaphorical idea of what we're doing as writers in terms of creating different versions of realities that we inhabit in lots of different ways. And if we can do that as writers, then I don't know, I feel like there's lots of other ways that we could potentially be inventing different experiences and alternative, you know, ways of moving through the universe. And I think in theory, it sounds much more exciting to lean into that yes than to say no and kind of confine us to a very, I don't know, static and linear way of existing. What do you think?
I'm tempted by the idea that I could become a god. So that would suggest that perhaps there is a god who's made me, who's in a similar situation.
That's a good answer. The thing that I find, maybe this is like a way to start wrapping it up in some way, but I mean, I do think it's interesting that, you know, when I started getting really getting into a lot of the things that I write about, and like I've written poem, I actually wrote a poem called Base Reality at one point, and you know, I've done a lot of writing about digital immortality and techno-spiritualism and a lot of these things that I think are considered very sci-fi. And when I would take them into poetry workshops, I definitely got a lot of, you know, pushback about, well, isn't this more like genre? Isn't this more like sci-fi? It's not really a good poetic, you know, topic, or this doesn't really seem, I don't know why, but the response that I would often get is like, this doesn't really feel like it's a good subject for this kind of poetry, or something to that effect. And I think obviously that's a reflection on the kinds of workshops that I probably found myself in. But I think my bigger point is that we talk about these things in a cultural sense as being sci-fi, but they really are, I think, themes that point to, you know, the fundamental elements of what it means to be a human being. And when we're talking about simulation theory, there's like a lot of, you know, philosophy and a lot of spirituality in that. We talk about, you know, life extension or digital immortality or cryogenics. We're kind of recapitulating themes that, you know, poets have been grappling with and writing about for millennia. And I just think it's funny how we tend to like pigeonhole or label certain subsets of these ideas with, you know, this is dystopian or this is sci-fi or whatever else, when they're really just variations on, again, the things that poets have been obsessed with for time immemorial. So it's exciting to get to talk about these kinds of things and write about these kinds of things and just not feel like, oh, they're not poetic or they're too genre or whatever the case may be. It's really nice to not feel categorized or compartmentalized in that way.
Yeah, good answer. And well, so finally, is there anything you'd like to mention that you've got coming up that you're working on?
Well, there's always a lot coming up. I mean, I would say just knowing some of the poets who are, part of the Pentarac circle, and I presume like a lot of the poets who listen to the podcast, if anyone's interested in some of the things we were talking about with regard to blockchain poetry or thinking about using AI in some way, like those are, two things that are very near and dear to my heart, of course. And I think what I really have enjoyed with the verse verse and with my own practice over the past 2 years has been sort of helping to onboard curious poets into these areas. And I know that I myself was quite intimidated when I started working with AI, for example, as someone who comes from a language and literature background who has no, I was never a computer scientist. I never like learned how to code in school or anything. So learning how to use some of these tools was definitely intimidating at first. And I think I've had such an incredible experience doing this that I now would love to continue to kind of share these tools with anyone who's interested. So I guess I would just say, again, if anyone's curious about some of these crazy things we've been talking about, yourself included, then,
Yeah, definitely.
let's keep the conversation going on that. I'm happy to help on board. I'm happy to have separate brainstorming sessions on, like, if you're interested in making an NFT or an NFT book, let's talk about that. I'm personally really invested in a lot of innovations that are happening in the publishing world. So that's definitely of interest. And the verse verse also has a lot of cool opportunities coming up to showcase new work by poets who are just starting to engage with the blockchain and engage with generative text for the first time. So yeah, I mean, I'm hoping that we can continue to sort of bring in, more curious experimental poets into the thriving but very small still community of writers in Web3. And that's really, a very important like journey that I think we're on there at the verse verse. So I would say come on in and just, give it a try if you're at all interested.
Well, I'll be in touch for one, definitely.
Excellent.
I need to find out more. And
That's
but
great.
this has been so great today. I've learned so much anyway today. Thank you so much for this. This has been a wonderful conversation, and I'm really grateful that you've agreed to come on the podcast.
Well, thank you again very much for having me, and I appreciate the wide-ranging conversation. It's always a pleasure to talk about some of these some of the edges of, the edges of poetry and language. So I appreciate it very much.